Thanks so much for coming to this Hot Talks session with John Smithson. My name, as Jess mentioned, is Jen Kuzmic. I'm the Canadian Bureau Chief for C21Media.net, which is a trade publisher specializing in the business of television, mobile, and broadband entertainment. I'm also the editor of C21's Factual Week, which is an online newsletter dedicated to the world of factual television and documentary. I've been writing about factual television and documentary filmmaking for over a decade now, speaking almost daily with commissioning editors, distributors, producers, and documentary lovers. And it's astounding how often they reference films and programming made by Darlo Smithson. Based in the UK and now part of British super indie IMG Media, Darlo Smithson has achieved worldwide recognition for its groundbreaking documentaries, feature docs, series, and docudrama. Has won numerous prestigious international awards and has created hits for virtually every major factual television broadcaster in the world. Just a few of John's credits include feature documentaries like this year's Deep Water and the now legendary Touching the Void, which still is the UK's most successful theatrical doc ever produced. And then there are the docudramas, a genre that Darlo Smithson has pioneered. Titles like The Falling Man, which is about the 9/11 jumpers, or historical docudramas such as Equals MC Squared and The Sum, and then there are the hit series for Discovery, such as Seconds from Disaster and I Shouldn't Be Alive. These titles and many more have changed the very definition of documentary and have raised the bar for what makes compelling factual television. They were spawned through Darlo Smithson's renowned storytelling craft, fierce commitment to creative integrity, business acumen, and a knack for just knowing what will inspire audiences. So it is with great honor that I introduce John Smithson.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Jen. I will be renewing my subscription to C21 immediately. very nice to be in Hot Docs. I've only been here once before, very briefly a few years ago, so it's nice to be back in Toronto. And also, this is a first for me. I've never been to an event that has ever had sponsorship from the UK Trade and Investment Department. I've never had a penny from the British government. So this is a sort of, I don't know how much they, is anyone here? I hope not, but it's a very great honor to have sponsorship at last. Recently, my company, Darlo Smithson, has had a pretty good run with Survival, from Touching the Void to the 20 hours of high-end I Shouldn't Be Alive that we made for Discovery. Survival is sort of in our blood at the moment, just at the moment anyway. So somehow it seemed appropriate to apply this survival idea to the wonderful yet sometimes horrible world of documentary production. I'm sort of using doc in a really wide sense of the word today. Let's say non-fiction is a better way of defining it, I suspect. So how do you come out alive and, who knows, come out happier, more effectively fulfilled, and even with a bit more money than when you started? How do you do that in this sort of magical world that we're all in? As I say, making docs, it can be wonderful. When you're making great stuff, there's nothing like it. Everyone loves you. You can pick up awards by the bucket load, and it's a great job. But it's a shit job as well, because as many of you here know all too well, it can be pretty horrible. You sometimes feel, I still feel, sometimes broadcasters are stuck in Victorian times. They're the mill owners, and we, of course, are the workers at the looms. And sometimes it still feels that way, you know, despite the huge sort of balance of power that is changing, particularly in the UK. And documentary hell is a sort of genuinely horrible place. I've been there, I'm sure lots of you have, and I'm sure, I hope not too many of you are going through it right now, because it's a pretty grim time where every idea you either pitch is rejected, no one will see you, you become a non-person, and it really is a pretty shitty existence. And I think most people who've been there know just how grim it is. Don't give up. So what I want to do is to give you my own tips for survival based on my involvement as a producer, a director, as an executive producer, as a creative director, and all the various other things I've done, and the sort of hundreds of hours of docs that I've been involved with. Some of them I've been immensely proud of. Some of them have been turkeys. That's life. That's the way it goes. And but from all this, I think I've learned survival lessons, and also from building a company just from my spare bedroom 10 or 15 years ago to something now, which is one of the bigger factual indies around here. So what I thought I'd do today, as well as showing you some clips of recent work, I always prefer to see clips in these sessions. It's much more interesting than me prattling on. And a few sneak previews of some shows we've got coming up. And I think, hopefully, these will reinforce some of the points I want to try and make this morning. Also, this is quite a long session, and rather than me just banging on forever, I would really like to stop about halfway through and genuinely try and get some question and answers and discussion about anything. Very happy to discuss absolutely anything. The more controversial, the better. That's sort of the way I like it. So here we go, then. What I thought I would do to give this a bit of discipline and stop it being just a general ramble is to give you sort of my top 10 tips for a long and happy life in documentary production. I tried to make it really nitty-gritty, practical stuff rather than sort of big-picture strategic waffle, just because I think it's sort of helpful. But apologies if many of the things I'm saying are a sort of statement of the bleeding obvious, but nevertheless, I'll say them. I guess number one, and I know it's a really infuriating thing, but there's nothing that beats a track record. If you're a commissioning editor, what do you do? Who do you give the commission to? The new kids on the block, the idea might be great, but what have they done? Or the company or the creative team with the track record who can put their money where their mouth is, who can deliver what they say they will deliver. Nothing succeeds like success in doc production. A good show will nearly always need, a good show will nearly always lead to another show. That's a simple reality of what we all do. At Dulles Smithson, we make around 80 to 100 hours of high-end docs each year. And we really try and mix it up into different genres. And one of the things I'm sort of quite fixated about in what I do within the company is to, how do you hold on, particularly as you get bigger, how do you consolidate and build the reputation you have? Because ultimately that informs everything you do, and ultimately that's the biggest driver to get the work that you need to survive. So the way I try and do it is each year, try and have one or two films, preferably three, that really sort of tent poles in the sense that they hold up the quality image of the company, that they get noticed. They may not enhance our bank balance, but they sort of make you happy. They make you a magnet for talent, which is vital. And, you know, they might pick up an award, but above all, they keep your profile in a public place. And with thousands of companies doing what I do and what many of you do, you know, 1,000 or more companies around the world, you've got to be noticed. So here's the first selection of clips, which really are four films that I'm very proud of, which are very much in that sort of quality reputation category. So let's roll those clips. Thanks.
I see this not as this person's death. In June of 2002, 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart was abducted in the middle of the night from her Salt Lake City bedroom. Elizabeth was the most unlikely of victims in a crime that seemed without motive. Her abduction was so bizarre and unique a case that it transfixed America.
Yeah, so four films that I think did what we wanted them to do. Touching the Void, which many of you may be familiar with, our first ever theatrical documentary, and that's an area I'm very happy to talk about at the end, because it's I have very mixed feelings about the potential for that market, particularly in the UK, despite having made the most successful by a mile that the UK has ever produced. I wish I could do more like that. Who wouldn't? Because it was just a fantastic experience. And an extraordinarily talented director in Kevin MacDonald. Falling Man, the second clip, I think has been shown in Canada and is soon to be shown, I think it was on the CBC, and then I think it's going to be shown in very shortly in the US. One of the most difficult films I've ever done, because on that extraordinarily sensitive 9/11 subject, and a really fine line between sort of voyeurism and exploitation. For those of you not seen the film, we really followed the story of one of those jumpers, and in the journey to identify that man, we learned so much about the events of that day from a very different perspective. So extraordinarily powerful film that's, you know, delighted to say is up for a British Academy Award next month. Elizabeth Smart, a film that we haven't for legal reasons been able to show in America, but soon will be able to. Again, wonderful access, beautifully made by an English director called James Kent, one of those films that just sucks you in to this extraordinary kidnap story that many of you would be familiar with. And finally, Deep Water, our latest theatrical doc, which again is getting release in North America, I think, this summer. Again, lessons for me from that film. Immensely proud of that film. It's won awards, but obviously just didn't resonate in the box office in the way that Touching the Void did, which again says to me something about this world of theatrical documentaries and where we should best place our sort of finest work. Do we try and put it in the cinema or do we put it in TV? But all areas for discussion later. All of those four films had really one thing in common. They were cracking stories. And really that's my number two point. Never, ever, ever forget the power of the good story. It transcends everything. Last year, I had to do something for the BBC in London. It was about storytelling, one of those big sort of creative days that the BBC seemed pretty fixated about doing. They asked me to write sort of five bullet points from the sort of the spiel that I had to do about the power of the story. And I found them on the plane coming over and thought I'd just download them to you now. Just these were just five spur-of-the-moment bullet points about which really touch on the importance of storytelling. The story is king. Every other element in the program is secondary. Don't find the story in the cutting room. Do it before you shoot, because too often it's only in the cutting room, and often it's too late. Find the dramatic core of the story and strip away the extraneous elements. Too often I see films where you can't see the wood for the trees, and strip away those extraneous elements. Just really cut it down to your core story. don't sacrifice narrative and attempt to create something visually stunning. Too often, I see visuals, of course, are incredibly important, but story beats visuals in my book, and too often I see story sacrificed on the altar of sort of the visual playground. And finally, don't depend on narration to get you out of a story hole. Often you see that where it's only by putting a mountain of commentary on a film that you can actually tell the story. If you're doing that, it means you've not nailed the story at the beginning. So those were my sort of the things that I did at the BBC talk. And really underpinning that is a sort of little rant of mine. Forgive me if there's any directors in the room. I used to be a director. I one day probably will go back and make some films. I love directors. I tolerate them. I indulge them. I pay them lots of money. I lavish praise on them. If they're great, I love them beyond anything virtually in life. I'm in total admiration of their skills. But I am bored, rigid of going into the cutting room, which I do a lot of my time, and having to say almost the same things time after time after time. I keep thinking I'm just going to leave a sort of, just leave an iPod with my sort of notes playing, because I have to say, it seems like I say the same thing. You're not nailing the story. It's confusing. Where are the key story beats? What's the narrative progression? And it drives me bonkers when I hear back, oh, it will change when we put the music in. Or we're still, wait till we've done the grade. No brilliance by the grader is ever going to fix a broken story. No crap structure is ever going to be fixed by eye-popping CGI or stunning visuals, unless you're the BBC's Planet Earth, I suppose. But so get the fundamentals right. Apply them to whatever story you're telling. Don't let the story just emerge. Make it emerge the way you want. Plan your structure. Plan what people are going to say. Make them say it, ethically. Get your building blocks in place. Then do the pretty stuff then. I'm not anti-visuals. I love visuals. Of course I do. But it's storytelling is fundamental to what we do in non-fiction and in fiction as well. I remember meeting once in Toronto the guy, some head honcho at Alliance Atlantis, who was running the CSI franchise. And he proudly boasted to me of being a script Nazi. I love that term, a script Nazi. They were obsessive about getting the scripts right. Well, we've seen what a global hit CSI is. And I like that. I like being a script Nazi or a story Nazi. You know, that's just focus in that obsessive way on getting your story right. And I'd say survival as an independent producer or director or production company is in the bag. The sort of third big point is really, don't bite the hand that feeds you, caress it. By that, I mean the hand that feeds, of course, is those lovely, lovely broadcasters and commissioning editors without whom we'd all not exist. You know, quite simply, we're in a relationship business. If you don't get on with people, if you prefer confrontation to conciliation, then go and be a lawyer or go and work in IT support or something. you've got to work closely with the people who commission you. Don't turn off the charm once you bag the commission. You know, it's not rocket science to get on with the people that commission you, yet the number of sort of clashes you hear about. Why, if you were a commissioning editor, do you want to work with someone who behaves as a complete asshole unless they just deliver absolutely brilliant stuff? You know, so be nice, make them look good. Give them a creative stake in what you're doing together. You know, make them your friend, not your enemy. You know, always keep them in the loop of what you're doing. Don't give them nasty surprises. They'll always come back and kick you in the teeth if you sort of say everything's fine when it clearly isn't fine. Never overhype. I'm a great believer in never overhyping stories. Too often people desperate to get commissions promise the world and then you see the cut and there's no story. So I just think it's so important, that relationship. You know, because if you establish that relationship, then fantastic things happen. You know, Falling Man, which is probably the most successful film we did in terms of reputation last year, it was one of those magical things for a production company. The commissioning editor phoned us up and saying, I'd like you to make this film. You know, that's my idea of a nice commission. They phone you. You know, not exactly much work there, but it's not quite as simple, because once they say that, my God, you can't screw that film up, because it's the sort of crown jewel. And in this case, a man called Hamish Mycura at Channel 4 in the UK, who saw the story of The Falling Man and loved it, and said, I think you should make a film on that. So I was excited to. I loved it as much as he did. But it's a sort of, it's a commission you could not screw up. So easy to get, difficult to execute. But it was about relationships. He knew that he could work with us and he would give us that baby and we would nurture that baby and deliver the film. He can't, commissioning editors can't make films, we have to make them. So again, it was right down to that relationship. The fourth thing I feel really strongly about, and we get into slightly hotter water, or have been in the past in hot water over this, is about being commercial is not criminal. It's a real bugbear of mine, this idea that being commercial can somehow destroy your creative integrity. You know, occasionally I still believe there's a sort of subculture in documentary that you about selling out, that you need to feel the pain so that you don't compromise your creative integrity. I think this is all, to use a fine English phrase, bollocks. I mean, it's not true in my book. It's not, you can have it both ways. There's a wonderful, magical double whammy of doing shows, of doing films that rate and that are high quality. What could be better than that? Ticking both boxes. In fact, it's a triple whammy because you can have quality and the ratings and create something that sells around the world. So you get that other magical thing, a share of the back end. And for many years, this was the lifeblood of Dahlia Smithson as we were growing. The money we made on making films that sold around the world, we used to put straight back into development. So this virtuous circle, that money would fund our development to create more ideas. And that was really something that enabled us to grow. That idea that, you know, you're, by selling one thing, you were paying for the next thing. And it worked brilliantly. We go further than that now. We as a company very specifically target, as well as the UK market, we target the US market. 75% of our turnover is from the US. And for us, the Holy Grail is the long-running series. We work hard to create series that are designed specifically to work. Many of you here know that market very well. You know, these are slick, smart, tightly structured and formatted shows that sort of work right out of the box. You know, they're designed in really close cooperation with the planners, the creatives, the schedulers from these networks to do very specific things, to hit target demos, male, female, younger skewing, all the rest of it. So it's a different sort of program making from the conventional documentary model that we do in the, you know, in the UK, but it's something I think that's a very, you know, has a real value. It's the lifeblood of our company because, you know, we try and balance our output between series and specials. And the joy of series is that they can take no more work to get commissioned than a single hour. And you can suddenly get 13 hours or 20 hours or something like that. They give you real volume. You can keep in constant production. They're a great training ground to push people through the system. You can really push the envelope with sort of innovation, CGI, reenactment, and so on in these sort of shows. Yes, they're commercial, but I really believe as much creativity and pure skill goes into these sort of shows than something big and glossy that wins all the awards like Touching the Void. So here in the next selection of clips are examples, clips from three of the big series that we do. Two have been seen and one is about to be shown. Okay, so can we run those clips?
A mobile generator powers up Phantom Woman Zero on USS Forrestal, and an armorer plugs in a pigtail. 10:51 and 21 seconds. Pilot Jim Mangan flips the power switch. A stray electric current surges through the fighter jet. The safety pin is not in position. There's nothing to stop the current as it travels all the way to the launch pod. It activates a zooming rocket. The rocket crosses the rear deck of the ship, chest high, at speed.
I went under the water just to try to see where the crop was. As I started to go towards the crop, it came for me.
Ah!
trapped in a death roll, a spinning maneuver used by crocodiles to drown and dismember their prey. At the junction north of the bank, officers and civilians are still pinned down. Michael Horan bleeds heavily from a stomach wound. Tracy Bishop is trying to keep him quiet.
You can't tell me to shut up. Please don't scream. Because we couldn't see the gunman. We didn't know if they were going to walk around the car at any minute and just kick us out. You wanted to survive, but then you kind of told yourself, well, if I die, just make sure I don't feel it. I don't want to know about it. You had a sense that, you know what, this could be it. And I felt bad for my mom.
Officer Whitfield and Sergeant Haynes realize nobody is coming to rescue them.
Oops. Yeah, so that, you know, as I say, very specifically targeted for that, very National Geographic, Discovery, the international versions of those channels, very, you know, targeted to work for them all. You know, as I say, I'm as proud of those as I am of some of the sort of posh documentaries we do as well. And, you know, they're great. Like Seconds from Disaster, we were asked to try and redesign the disaster genre by the then head of National Geographic. We did, and, you know, we got 45 hours out of it of really high quality television. I shouldn't be alive very much in the wake of Touching the Void. 20 hours of very sophisticated reenactment, fantastic stories of survival, the new series, Situation Critical, you know, to replace when Seconds from Disaster runs out of legs. You know, so important to keep these series going if you're trying to have a company that somehow survives and prospers. Back to my magical top 10 list of tips to survive. I guess the number five, the one I, again, feel really strongly about, is never look back, never look down, just look forward. You know, in this business, shit happens. It happens every day. You know, just now, I've got two very big productions which are both in a really bad state. You know that feeling when you view the rough cut, you go into the cutting room, and you feel physically sick. You know, when there's absolutely nothing you can say nice about the film other than, well, it's all there. In fact, you can't even say that because it patently isn't there. But, you know, it's what we do, and we have to sort them, and we will sort them. You know, Falling Man took week after week after week to get right, and when I first saw that, you know, again, I had that nausea. But it's, you don't go back, don't have fear, just fix it. And you've got to move on. You know, passion and emotion are fine in this business. Commissioning editors want it. But Seconds from Disaster. Could have been worse. I was going to say it's not life or death as the Hot Docs banner went through my brain. So it's really, you know, just get on with it, you know, because as long as you accept that crap will happen virtually every single day, then you just got to move on. And the good thing is this business is constantly changing. So if you fall out with a commissioning editor or a broadcaster, they'll be, you know, the commission, they will move on in a year or 2 years. You know, it's fine. And rebuild your relationship with the new guys. And I think that's a real advantage of the fact we're in the business we are. At number six is really accept and embrace that we're in the fashion business. You know, the core values, of course, remain the storytelling, the power of the filmmaking, of course. But don't be afraid of change. Embrace it. You know, if you're thrown by change, then go and work in a bank. Don't work in documentary production. You know, because you, to survive in this business, you've got to stay ahead of the curve. You know, just don't get stuck doing the same sort of story in the same sort of way. Otherwise, you'll just die a long, lingering documentary death, which is a horrible way to go. You know, a bit ago at home, I found the PACT is our the British Producers Organization, and I found their 1993 directory of independent producers, the one that lists all the independent production companies in the UK. It was like discovering one of those Discovery Channel shows, discovering some ancient artifact, because it was incredible how many companies, this was just 1993, how many companies that were big then had now just slid away. And for me, one of the key reasons they had just slid away is this failure to adapt to what the marketplace wants. You know, in this business, intelligence, as in, you know, not brain power, but, you know, knowledge, is everything. Not industrial espionage intelligence, but just a bit of legitimate intelligence, intelligence gathering is vital. Read the trades, go to every event, every market, talk to as many people as you can, keep your ear closely to the ground. The more you do that, the more likely you'll keep ahead of the game. You know, for me, one of the biggest challenges in the factual marketplace has been the rise of docudrama. There are fantastic opportunities here for producers and directors of talent and opportunity. And one of our survival strategies as a company has been to aggressively target this area and build ourselves a serious reputation as a company that can deliver in this challenging but very, very hazardous area. I would estimate that about 3/4 of our output, what's that, 60, 70 hours a year, have some element of dramatic reenactment or recreation in them. And here's a selection of some of our recent work in this genre.
Stop here! I'm cutting on this novel now! without regard to human life. The kamikaze strategy is very demoralizing and very effective.
Okay, I was, time's cracking on. I was going to talk a bit more in detail about those, but I won't now, but if you want to ask any questions. I guess the lesson of that cluster of clips is, you know, docudrama is such a vital area, and it's the mixture of techniques, and each of those films had a slightly different balance. Some were 100% drama, some were integrating drama and archive and interview, some were doing that also with CGI. It's the mixing the techniques. It's also finding a way of moving on with the genre, because I think there's almost overkill in docudrama at the moment. So we're looking, and I say that as one of the key practitioners in that area, but we're looking what's the next thing. But it gives you some example of the range of what we do in that sort of genre. Back to my my survival list, my top 10 tips. And at number 7, size matters, and I'm talking here about the size of ambition. The biggest trend that I can see on both sides of the Atlantic in nonfiction is that broadcasters are looking for the big idea that bursts out of the sort of crowded marketplace, the packed schedule that they all work in. Cheap and cheerful ideas will always get made. That's an economically driven fact of life. The real squeeze is in the mid-budget, middling sort of idea. For broadcasters, less but bigger is better. And from where I sit, the more ambitious, the more audacious the idea, the better. I mean, I sometimes think it's easier to get a $5 or $10 million commission than a $200,000 or $300,000 commission, because people are seeking the big thing rather than the ordinary. I mean, easier said than done, of course. But for me, this is the real area of interest in the market at the moment. And certainly one of the things I'm doing at the moment, one of the biggest and certainly the most exciting thing I've ever done, really just came from a completely mad, spur of the moment, madcap idea. I said to a well-known American head of program saying, don't suppose you'd ever think of doing this? And she said, yeah, it's fantastic. And so just from that one fusion, a 20-second conversation, we have a project that could be, that is really genre-busting and fascinating. It may not happen, so I don't want to talk about it too much, but that's what's exciting at the moment, that ability to really push the boundaries of creativity with the ideas that get noticed. Just like with docudramas, these big ideas are really a key survival strategy for us. And as I say, there are fantastic commissions to be had out there. And as I say, also the more, I've got 1,000 competitors, anyone here who's in a production company has got the same. So the higher you go up that food chain, the more ambitious your ideas, frankly, the less competitors you're gonna have, because broadcasters are really only gonna trust the really big projects with companies they know who've got the track record and the ability to deliver. So, you know, it's a key area. And the other thing for me, why I love them, is they're just fun. Who doesn't want to play with a big train set? You know, and that's what these things can be. They just can be really fun to do. At number 8 on my list is don't get pigeonholed. There's a real danger in this business that you get known for doing just one thing. You know, you're the guys that do the serious films about Iraq or the lovely sweet films about old people in love. You know what I mean? It's even worse if you have a hit because, well, it's not really a big problem, but it sort of is a problem because people want more of it. You know, we once had fantastic success with a series called Black Box about aviation disasters for Channel 4 and for Discovery. And from that point onwards, we've never really been able to escape that, for part of our output, that disaster genre. Seconds from Disaster, you saw earlier, you know, 10 years later, was very much the new generation version of that. So, you know, after Touching the Void, we suddenly became the company that does survival and adventure. And, you know, I hate it when people say, you can't do drama, you can't do feature films, you can't do factual entertainment. Rubbish. It's all storytelling. And you can apply those skills to any genre. So, you know, don't get pigeonholed and don't put all your eggs in one basket. I know it's difficult in certain countries, but it's terrible if you're just reliant, in the UK, say, just on Channel 4, just on the BBC, and so on, because you've got no options. And it's great, I think, if the broadcasters know you work for other people. You know, that's healthy competition in my book. So it makes absolute sense to work for as wide a range of broadcasters as possible. Another of our survival strategies, despite being predominantly a mainstream factual company, that we try and do as wide a range of material as possible. And here in this sort of final selection of clips, these are really just things that illustrate some of the, you know, the different sort of material we do that doesn't fit into the easy categories that I've done for the previous selection. So let's run the final selection. Thank you very much.
At 10:18, the plane is lined up on the runway. While the world waits with bated breath, inside the plane, the only problem seems to be the strap on Fernando's helmet. At 10:29 and 32 seconds, the throttles are opened.
Yeah, so for something I never thought we'd do, which is pure fantasy, you know, dragons don't actually exist, but it was incredibly good fun to do. And then from that to almost incomprehensible cosmology with that very, very stylish blue chip series with one of the world's most eminent scientists, to something I love, which is stunts like blowing up, trying to replicate, would the gunpowder plot, anyone who knows English history knows about the attempt to blow up the Houses of Commons and kill the king, and we tried to prove would it have worked, and that was fantastically good fun to do, and there's real appetite. People ask us all the time, can we do another stunt like that one, and I'd love to, but they're not that easy to find. And then finally, the sort of access documentary. You know, we spent 3 years following the filming of the world's biggest plane. So again, all opportunities, different sort of ways that you can just build your portfolio, all part of the bigger survival game. Okay, very quickly, just two final points at the end of my list of 10. Something again, I feel strongly about, you don't switch off when you get the commission. Execution is everything. It's so hard getting commission. So tough to put together all your finance. You can spend months, sometimes years, getting a project up and running. Beware, there's a real danger that you'll be all burned out in just getting to the start line. And it's really easy to lose interest at that point and to focus on the next thing, to outsource your beloved project and move on to something else. This is a really dangerous thing to do. If you sold the project, you're the person on the line to deliver it. Somehow you've got to drag yourself up, get motivated, and focus on delivering the show that you've been talking about forever. So many people don't do that, and it goes wrong, and it's all about building that track record. My number one point, you know, that's the way to do it. Is the way not to do it is just to move on to the next thing and ignore the commission you've spent forever trying to get. The final survival tip, and certainly in my view the most important, just relates to talent. Never ever forget that you're only as good as the people you work with. This is a talent business, and it's a meritocracy, a flawed meritocracy, but nevertheless it is a meritocracy. Talent, despite what I said about directors earlier, talent has to be nurtured, indulged, encouraged, loved, and occasionally beaten into submission as well. And a great director, a fantastic editor, a talented DP, and I'm a bit biased here, but a really great producer and a really sharp EP can utterly transform your half-baked idea that you've hoodwinked some poor, unsuspecting broadcaster into commissioning. They can turn it into a magical jewel of the film. You know, I had some involvement in every single one of those clips I've shown today, but in every case, it was actually all about the sort of brilliant individuals, and not just the directors, it's the APs, it's the coordinators, the researchers. You know, TV is ultimately a team business, and never, ever, ever forget that.
Okay, so we're going to have a question and answer period now, and I would really, really encourage you to just sort of come up. There are microphones around the room. Put your hand up if you have a question, and we'll just sort of get at it. Off the top, are there any questions? Well, I have a few, which is good. You mentioned sort of at the beginning of your address, John, the plight of theatrical docs. Now, Hot Docs is a place to premiere theatrical docs. And I know that you have sort of some interesting thoughts on sort of the state of the business of that.
I don't know what the perception is in, I don't know if most people here are Canadian or what, I don't know what the perception is from Canada or even America. I mean, I'm really worried that we're sort of overdoing theatrical, actually, that everyone in a rush, you know, who doesn't want to make a documentary that goes out in a cinema? Of course, it's wonderful. I sort of worry that there's too many of them around. I also worry that the quality is slipping. And quite a lot of the ones I'm aware of, you know, if you read the back of Variety every week, you see how many, 5 or 6 reviewed, you never ever hear from them again. They just sink without trace. I worry that there's almost too many out there and that the quality threshold is many of these ideas actually probably wouldn't even get commissioned as a single hour of television. And so I think a lot more of them should be strangled at birth. You know, I really do. I mean, for me, the quality threshold for a theatrical document, you know, is right up there, whereas television is there. To make a documentary that people actually want to spend their, how much is a cinema ticket here, $12, $15, whatever, you know, to make a documentary that people want to spend their money on a Friday night, it has to be truly exceptional. It can't be something that's just a vanity project or something you've got a burning desire to do that you can't get onto television. So, and certainly in the UK, which is the market I know the best and where we, you know, our ear is very close to the ground, I think there's a real sense that everyone thought after Touching the Void, let's pile into this, distributors, film companies, this is great. You know, they're cheap to make, they make lots of money, Touching the Void went into profit. It's not happened. There's not been a single successful British documentary, financially that is, since Touching the Void. And the only things that have really popped out in the UK since, you know, have been Penguins and Al Gore. And nothing else. And okay, the UK market might be slightly different because there's still, you know, particularly with the new channels showing a lot of high quality documentaries, More 4, the Channel 4 digital channel, and BBC 4, the BBC digital channel, you know, you can see a really cracking documentary virtually every night of the week. So, you know, I'm just not sure if the appetite is there. And certainly a lot of the productions I'm doing now, which we would have thought we were going to do as a theatrical. Instead, we're doing them as feature length, but we're doing them straight with TV money and putting them out on TV. And frankly, I'd rather 10 million people around the world see a documentary, which will probably happen with Falling Man, rather than 20,000 people in various art house cinemas. That's my own view of it. I make films for people to see, not just for my mates. So I'm, you know, I love theatrical documentary, don't get me wrong, but I just think, let's not ruin it. You know, and I think, you know, because there is no quality threshold, because commissioning editors in television act as a quality filter and stop the weak ideas getting onto screen, that's less the case. You know, people somehow, I don't know how they do it, seem to get theatrical docs funded. And as I say, when in fact, a lot should be strangled at birth. So that's my feeling about them. We've just got to be really picky. Otherwise, we're just going to kill it for everybody.
Go ahead. There's a mic right there.
Hi, my name is Marco Visalberghi, I'm from Italy. I was proud enough to be part of the jury that gave the first prize to Deepwater at the Rome Film Festival.
Let me buy you a drink, thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. But I was very impressed about this documentary because in somehow it's, well, first of all, it's one of the most beautiful film I have seen, but at the same time, is old-fashioned kind of documentary. It doesn't seem to follow the new tendency and this and this. It's a very traditional, very well-made, and what has struck all of us in the jury was the storytelling. That the storytelling was coming out beautifully with the most simple pictures. Most of them were very bad quality and so forth. So it's there were nothing fancy, nothing very update, but was absolutely brilliant. And that is it was quite remarkable. So I was thinking, this film, for in your opinion, will go out in the theater? Will is designed for movies or is designed for television? Who put the money in it?
Thank you for your kind. The Deepwater was the one, that was the UK trailer I showed earlier. It was fantastic fun to do it because although, you know, I'm responsible as much as anybody for flooding the world market with docudramas, but personally I'm slightly bored of the genre, and what I loved about Deepwater is we just made it purely with archive and interview. And to make a film to work in the cinemas for 90 or 100 minutes was one of the most difficult challenges I've ever had, and I loved doing it because it was just, back to what I was saying about the power of the story, the only thing we had going for us was the power of the story. So, of course, I'm biased, but I would urge you to see that film whenever it comes to Canada or the US, which I think is sometime in the summer. It will get a limited theatrical release. So, fantastic. And you know, I'm personally a little stale on doing docudramas, and I'm getting my personal kicks on things like Falling Man, which had no reenactment, on Deep Water, which had no reenactment. So I'm sort of, in what I'm doing, I'm either loving doing pure documentary or going the whole hog and doing pure drama. But as a company, we're not. I'm just saying that's just my personal creative restlessness. The finance people you asked me about, we've got a big budget. I don't know what it was, about $3.5 million, because immensely complicated film to do. Financed by the same people that did Touching the Void, but Channel 4, Film 4, Pathé, and so on. The final important point about Deep Water, which is why that there was a film, won the top prize at the Rome Film Festival, got the most fantastic reviews, fantastic press right across the UK, got a theatrical release in all the key cinemas in London and the rest of the country, did very little business. It was a terrible time of the year. James Bond had just released and something else. But it is so difficult to get an audience to go and see a pure documentary. And, you know, I don't regret for a second that went on the big screen, but it proved to me just how, when you do a film which people seem to think is of really genuinely high quality, just how difficult it is to get a general audience, particularly in the multiplex environment, to go and see a pure documentary like that. You know, it is such a tough challenge we set ourselves to try and expect that documentaries will thrive in the cinema. You know, I urge people to keep trying if they really believe in it, but you know, I think it's the hardest thing to do in non-fiction production, to find a documentary that actually is a hit. You know, and we've seen Fahrenheit 9/11 and Columbine, and, you know, there's reasons why films have broken out, but it's one in a thousand, isn't it? So anyway, that's probably enough on the world of theatrical documentary. But thank you for your kind comments.
May I ask a second question to you? There have been a lot of discussion among the authors and yourself. Should we put some reenactment or not? Because I'm trying to put myself in front of a story like this. You think, well, you know, this story will never work without some good reenactment that bring the void. There have been any discussion on that?
I've got a simple rule about reenactment. You do it when you've got no other... You do reenactment to take you inside the jeopardy of a story. And you only do it if you have no other way to do it. At the moment, there's such a trend to do it. You know, I've seen some shows where the BBC did a space race, space race series. You know, the space race is probably the most archived event in world history. There must be hundreds and thousands of kilometers or miles of footage of the space race. Yet, you know, famous moments were reenacted. Why reenact when you've got archive? You know, I love reenactment. You know, on Touching the Void, we had no choice. We had to reenact the two guys up a mountain because there was no archive film. But when we did that Waco film for Discovery and Channel 4, there was all that amazing archive that people will remember of the Waco siege. What's the point in recreating that? You use the archive and you recreate what isn't on archive, which was what happened inside David Koresh's compound. So I think it's common sense, but sometimes I see common sense going out of the window and stuff being recreated which should have been done on archive. Archive is great because it's real. You can't beat archive, and that's another of my rants, actually, that there's just too much reenactment. Although, as I say, I'm as guilty of it as anybody else.
Hi, you mentioned that embracing change and adapting to the marketplace is really important to yourselves. How are Dal Smithson adapting to the multiple platforms and converging marketplaces?
That's the real, that's the big, big question. I mean, when we had the first internet revolution, everyone said, what was your web strategy? And we all shrugged our shoulders because we didn't know. It sort of blew out. This time it's real, and there's this giant wave that's about to engulf us all, and we simply, if you're involved in production, if you're running a production company, you absolutely can't, you can't ignore it. So, I mean, one of the reasons I'm now, Dallas Smithson are now part of a much bigger group, one of the key reasons is because of the new media expertise that exists within that group. So, and one of the things we now have is a specific new media producer who sits with our development team. So every project we are now doing, we are factoring in what is the component.
What kinds of things are you doing?
I can't really talk about any of them.
But when you're doing
Jaina Bennett, the director of BBC Vision at MIPCOM, MIP last week, was talking about this whole 360, you know, commissioning. You know, very much, you know, some of the BBC projects we're talking about, absolutely, at least half the content on one of the projects we're talking about is non-broadcast. It's right across, you know, it's a... I hate not being able to talk about projects, but it's so competitive at the moment that you've just got to be really careful until you're absolutely up and running on something. But I think the thing is, you don't bolt on the new media elements at the end, you design them in at the beginning. That's what we are doing. But we're in the earliest stages. There's issues of control. Does the broadcaster control it? Does the production company control it? I think we're going to see sort of seismic, the whole tectonic plates of our world are changing. And in the, you know, within 2 years, I think we're going to have a very different story on this. You know, this time this revolution is for real.
Hi there. You talked about the most important thing was this story, and you mentioned, deciding what the story was and making your subjects sort of say what you want them to say, but you said to do this ethically. Can you discuss a little bit about what techniques you use in order to do this?
Blackmail, alcohol, drugs. I think it's a real skill that is sort of forgotten, actually, interviewing. You know, in documentary, often it's, you know, the assistant producer does the interview and whatever, and too many times you see an interview where I wish they'd gone back and got them to say it differently. It's just helping people, you know, as a producer and a director, you're ordering the story in a certain way to get the story beats to punch out. I think with your key contributors, you need to sit down and say, you know, this is the sort of section of the film where we want you to be saying this sort of thing. You know, I know you believe these sort of things. If you could put them in this sort of... You're not putting words into people's mouth. You're not, by editing, getting them to say things they don't believe. But you're just helping them to marshal their thoughts in a way that are helpful to you so that they work in the film. I mean, you know, you can either do it... You can either go incredibly long. So on Touching the Void or on Deep Water, on Touching the Void... Kevin MacDonald interviewed the key protagonist, Joe Simpson, for nearly 3 days. He was on screen for nearly an hour of the film. But sometimes, you know, you only have an hour to interview somebody. It's just knowing what your story is before. Too many interviews are fishing expeditions. There shouldn't be, too much research is done on camera rather than before you shoot. And it's just planning, so you know what the contributor's going to say, the contributor knows what they're going to say, it's not rocket science, and that you work with them to get their contribution as effective as you can. You're making them look good, and you're making your film good. As I say, it's absolutely not manipulation, it's just helping people to punch their weight. And interviews are so vital to films. The Blitz film you saw a clip of, the sync of the interviews on that film were some of the most brilliant I've seen recently, because the director is so good at working with contributors, and every little bit of sync that we cut to was just fantastic, because the director had spent weeks planning how they would slot into the film and what they would say. The same director, Louise Osmond, who went on to do Deep Water, and as we speak is now editing our follow-up film to Touching the Void. So, you know, real talented director who absolutely understands, in her case, because of her journalistic background, the power of the interview. You know, it's the core of your film. Otherwise, how else are you telling the story? Just narration. And you know what I think about narration. So it's so simple, but it's so often ignored. And I see so many interviews that are blurry and confused, and you're having to cut them to pieces just to get them to make sense, you know? So that's what I think about interviews.
There's actually a session on Saturday at Hot Docs about the art and science of interviewing.
Yeah.
Would disagree with that advice and say that you don't want to do any research before you talk to an interviewee. And the first time that they really talk about the subject matter should be when they're on camera, because oftentimes there's no way to recreate that initial enthusiasm, surprise, recollection, emotion. How do you, if you're going to do that pre-research, how do you keep an interview from being lifeless or just sound like a soundbite?
Your point is fair. Sometimes, you know, particularly if it's potentially enormously, you know, emotional or sensitive, on Touching the Void, Kevin MacDonald, the director, had never met Joe Simpson until the day they went into the interview studio where they were for 3 days. You know, I'd been dealing with Joe for more than a year or 2 years or something. So sometimes that freshness, you know, my rule isn't universal before. Sometimes that freshness and you can get more out of people by meeting them for the first time. But it's horses for courses or whatever. You know, it's just you adapt your interview strategy to the reality of what the person you're interviewing and the nature of those circumstances. On Falling Man, which had some of the most extraordinarily sensitive interviews you could ever imagine, in which people were talking about watching footage of their loved ones jumping from the top of the World Trade Center. You know, the director, Henry Singer, on that, had spent weeks assuring those contributors. You know, so he didn't just turn up one day and say, you know, tell me how it felt to see your brother jumping from the Twin Towers. You know, he spent weeks talking to them, assuring them, building their confidence, and then got some really fantastic, emotionally powerful material, which is what made that film work. So it's a different strategy for every interview rather than one universal rule.
Sure. I'm just going to ask if you could identify yourselves when you ask your question, please.
I'm Frank Redden from Indonesia. If I'm not mistaken, you were saying that many film companies in 1933 in UK that produced perhaps what you meant, ethnographic film, or like running out of business. Can you explain to me why is that?
Was that a reference when I said the pact, the directory of companies in the UK in 1993?
Yeah, right. If I'm not mistaken, this is what I...
No, my observation was just that television in the UK and in Canada and the US and France and Germany is very different in 2007 to 1993. And a lot of companies, you know, documentaries were made a certain way in 1993, which aren't made that way now. And a lot of those companies who were in that directory in 1993 have disappeared, because I can only assume they were trying to make documentaries the same way and nobody wanted them anymore. And whereas the companies that have survived from that, looking at this list of companies, are the ones that are, you know, you can't survive in this business making the documentaries you want to make. The skill is making, actually the biggest skill is you've got to let the commissioners believe they're making the documentaries they want to make, although in fact you're trying to make the documentaries you want to make at the same time, but it's a sort of sleight of hand. Did that make sense? Probably. But I'm just saying that a lot of companies who have just faded away have failed to adapt to what is clearly a changing market, and we all know that. Television, you know, is a dynamic change, you know, it is the fashion business. Interviews are in or out, presenters are in or out, CGI is everywhere, it's nowhere, reenactment is everywhere. You know, there's all these different trends, and you've got to evolve with the marketplace, but never forget the story. So that's what I meant about that point.
Hi, I'm Ainsley Vogel with Paperny Films in Canada. I wanted to ask you about working across multiple markets the way you clearly do. Elizabeth Smart, obviously an American story. Did you sell that into the US first? Did you pre-sell it into the UK? How did it play? Did it play in the UK? And also, Falling Man, obviously an American story, but commissioned by a British commissioner and told by an outsider, I guess, in many ways. How did that play across different markets differently? And just maybe talk a little bit about that.
Number one, we don't make any film until we have the finance to make at a budget level we believe we need to make the film. It would just be, I would have been bankrupt years ago. You never ever, you just don't start a film until you've got your finance in place. Number two, we virtually always, I think, a rule is it's very hard, without the UK, it's quite hard to finance a film You know, normally we finance most of what we do by UK and US, and on the really complicated things, particularly docudramas like the Lusitania film you saw, that was BBC, that was Discovery, that was NDR in Germany, it was MCIS in France. Sometimes we've got five or six. You're having to sell off all the big territories to finance your film, and the territories for us in importance are US and UK in sort of joint equal position, then France and Germany in sort of third and fourth position, sort of equal, then Australia, then Italy, Canada sort of, depending on the right situation and whether it's North America or just US. Sometimes we finance like Falling Man because everyone was fascinated by the film but nobody would touch it until they could see it. So we pitched it endlessly and everyone said it sounds fascinating, but it could be the most, you know, yucky, tasteless film imaginable. So that one we just financed with Channel 4 and with a big distribution advance on Channel 4 International, the distribution arm, in the hope that we would sell it around the world, which we subsequently have. So sometimes you do that. Elizabeth Smart was made predominantly with Channel 4, but with some money from Court TV in the US. So there's no one rule on, I mean, there's a rough rule of thumb. I would imagine I would be looking to get 80% of a budget out of US and UK, and the 20% out of rest of world, with normally France and Germany. That would be a very rough rule of thumb. But this is an incredibly complicated subject, and there are no simple there's no simple answers. But it is time co-production is a nightmare, is the simple truth. And increasingly, when you're having assertive partners, you know, getting a French broadcaster, a German broadcaster, an American broadcaster, and a British broadcaster, and an Italian, and an Australian, all of whom have got certain editorial rights, it's like trying to broker a UN resolution sometimes. So, you know, it is really tough thing to do co-production.
And do you find the films play well in both, just say the US and the UK marketplace equally well when they're finished?
Great stories work in every territory. You know, Touching the Void was about two classically English climbers, but it had a universal resonance. Elizabeth Smart, about a Mormon family and this incredible story of a kidnapping, played incredibly well in the UK. Falling Man, obviously 9/11 is an event that's touched us all and has worked in every territory. It's finding stories. We try, and virtually everything we do is international. You're looking for stories that have a resonance around the world. We tend not to do observational documentaries about sheep farmers in the northwest of England, you know, because they don't tend to play very well in the US. You know, we tend not to do parochial subjects. We tend to do bigger stories that have a resonance beyond just the UK or beyond the US or wherever.
I have a question.
Good, I battered you all into submission.
I have a question about the docudramas, and you know, it all sort of falls under the term of factual television. But when you've got something that's 100% drama, you know, where is your allegiance to the fact, and how do you be careful not to take too many liberties with the story? You know, you're still calling it factual television, yet there's certainly no archive or first person.
Yeah, I mean, we've been debating about docudramas as long as we've been making them, because they come in every shape and size and every level of veracity, from based on a true story, you know, to inspired by a true story, you know, which basically means, you know, you make up what you want in the script, you know, to absolutely scrupulous line-by-line annotation of every line of dialogue. You know, they come in all shapes and sizes. I have one sort of golden rule about docudramas. You know, when you buy a jar of jam, there's a label that tells you how much fruit is in it and how much sugar and how much other crap or whatever's in the jam. I think at the front of a docudrama, you have to label what's inside. You have to label, you know, is this a true story? Is it based on a true story? Is it accurate? Are there representative scenes? Are there composite characters? All these buzzwords, euphemisms that mean a whole lot of things. I think you mustn't be dishonest with the audience. You have to be clear. All the different types are legitimate as long as you are not trying to pretend everything you hear is true when it patently isn't. So it's being honest up front about what is to come. That's the key thing. And I think as long as that label at the front is very clear, and therefore you have no intention to deceive the audience, then you can do them any number of ways, you know. But there will be debates about docudrama for forever and a day, because that's, you know, and there are lots of dangers that are endemic within the genre.
But it's not going away.
I don't think so. There just seems an unstoppable appetite. And of course, you know, when they're good, they're brilliant. You know, for me, the best docudrama I've probably ever seen was actually a major movie, which was United 93, which I thought was the most stunning film, you know, made by an old colleague of mine from my Granada TV days. And I just thought that was a stunning piece of filmmaking that took you right inside this huge day in our recent history. Brilliant, brilliant docudrama.
We're just about at the end of our session, so we have a question right here.
You talked about big ideas and intelligence. What's the big idea that motivates you? What's your big idea?
I can't answer that. That's like one of those questionnaire type things, you know. Name your favorite joke, or who's your favorite footballer? A big idea that is just something, for me, the motivation is to do a story. I love finding new ways of doing television. I love mixing genres. I love pushing boundaries. I just love doing something that's just different from anyone has ever done before. That's, you know, I can't tell you the specific idea, but it's just doing something that everybody notices across the world of nonfiction television. That's what I like, projects that just really stand out. You know, the thousands of hours made every year just doing stuff that people actually remember. Those are the sort of ideas that I personally get my kicks out of doing. But and I can't, and it's audacity. It's the idea. God, it's bloody dangerous up here. So much hot air that it's just, so it's just, It's the audacity, thinking the unthinkable, using technology to your advantage, and doing things you never thought you could do. That's what keeps me happy.
I think we have time for one more question, and that's just about it. Any others?
Well, from our point of view of independent producer, we are facing a situation where the commissioning editor are looking more and more into their domestic stories, their stories that are related to their viewers, and are less and less interested in international story that can cover. Probably from your point of view, being at such a good level, is that true also for you or not?
You know, you're always going to, it's absolutely right that a British broadcaster or a Canadian or a French broadcaster want to do stories that particularly reflect their own country. And we still do some of those. You know, I still think it's, you know, it's really important to make, for me, making stories about what is happening in Britain. You know, so it's not, I slightly mislead you when you think everything we do is just the big international stories. I would still love to do, you know, a great British story, and we still do some of those. You know, I'm doing a very big crime story about a very big, iconic British crime that won't really sell outside of the UK. You know, I'm doing a drama at the moment about gay life in London that is not going to sell really beyond the UK, but it's absolutely fascinating about our home market. It's about mixing up your genres, and you know, the UK is such a vibrant, creative market. That sometimes it is nice just to make films for the UK market, and I absolutely respect the right of broadcasters, you know, to make films that appeal on subjects that are uniquely Canadian or French or Italian in interest. You know, it's a mixture of doing the international stuff and you know, the stories that really resonate to an audience in each of those countries that you're in.
But in terms of trends, do you think I'm right or not?
I think broadcasters are increasingly certainly in the UK, looking for shows that resonate within the UK. So yes, I do think you're right. Yeah, I think, but there'll always be room for the bigger stories that go beyond that. And to survive as a production company, you've got to do both. Never ever lose sight of your home market. And that's crazy. You know, you couldn't exist as a production company in the UK if you didn't work for the UK broadcasters. You know, that would be a really stupid thing to do.
Okay, I think that's all we have time for. So thank you very much for coming.